biggest moment for me was during COVID, and all I could do was sit in my garden. And I cleaned the entire garden, which was so full of like branches from the tree and like dirt and leaves for years and years. And I completely cleaned it out, and it suddenly became like full of color and green and everything. I was digging like my hands into the soil and everything, planting it and watering it. And that was the moment that I was like, I am not meant to live a life of working 45 hours a week in a job that I do not want, in an office, in a big city. I am here to be part of this soil.
It gives you sort of more of a sense of peace and more of a sense of belonging on the planet. It makes you feel like you're where you're meant to be. I think it sort of takes you back to a time when people weren't living in a capitalist hierarchy and lived with the land and for the land. A lot more fulfillment living like that, I think.
I think most of us, at least once in our lives, have had one of those epiphanies in nature that brings us into contact with the feeling of how life should be. It is these moments that bring alive the magic of life, that makes our connections with nature real, that remind us what is essential in life. These are the moments that challenge the capitalist logic, and at least in that instant, bring us into connection with an ecological wisdom that makes us feel a sense of harmony with the planet. Welcome to another episode of System Shift, a podcast that explores some of the pressing issues reshaping our world. Our guest today offers us his learnings from a lifetime of grounded radical alternatives that offer hope that holistic transformations are beginning to take place. We are joined by Ashish Kothari, environmentalist, author and co-founder of Galprovich, a non-profit organization that has been working on environmental issues and social issues for 45 years now. In this episode, Ashish challenges the dominance of modern science and technology, advocating for open source approaches and a commons perspective on knowledge and culture. He urges us to reconsider our relationship with the environment and encourages all to be active participants in democracy, to learn from diverse models and embrace values that enables a balance of give and take, mutual respect, and the interconnectedness of kinship. So without further ado, a warm welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks, Scott.
When I researched a little bit around this episode, I saw a photo of you with a small baby monkey holding your finger. And it made an impression on me and it made an impression on you. And I would like you to explain a little bit the background.
Sure. This was late last year. I was down in the southern Indian state of Kerala at an absolutely fantastic waterfall. And while climbing back up from the waterfall, there was this group of monkeys, mostly baby monkeys, playing with each other. And, you know, anybody who is interested in any kind of fun would, you know, love to watch baby monkeys playing, pulling their each other's tails and doing all kinds of stuff. So I was watching them. And then this one monkey climbed down to the handrails and I was looking at it, taking photographs. It was looking at me. And then I just lowered my camera because the way it was looking at me, I felt that there was a possible connection being made, but of course, very tentative. So then I reached out my hand. One of my colleagues who was with me said, be careful, it might scratch you. Actually, looking at a monkey eyes to eyes is supposed to be a sign of aggression. So that's why she was warning me. But here, the monkey actually bent down, smelt my finger, and then straightened up and reached out with its own fingers and touched me for must have been a split second. And for me, that one split second was like an eternity. And I actually wrote about that saying eternity in a second, because it encompassed within it for me all of what it meant to be part of nature, all of what it meant to be, you know, what evolution means, all of whatever we think of as creation, etc. And the intrinsic kinship that we have with other species, with the rest of nature, and being part of nature. And also then, of course,
flashing through my mind in terms of what we are doing as a species to the rest of nature, how we tend to think of ourselves as being superior, but in effect, actually, we are one, we are equal. And also, I think to me, it was a way, this and other such encounters I've had have also been a way of enhancing my own identity, where I'm seeing myself not as a Indian or even as a human being, but as a life form, as something that is kind of connected to the rest of the universe, so the interconnections, all of that flashed through my mind in that 1 second.
I found that very interesting because I had a rather similar experience. I was going skiing in a remote part in Sweden. I sat down, had my hot chocolate, and unaware to me, you had a little deer under the rock where I was sitting. And none of us noticed each other. I think it was sleeping. But when I bent forward, I saw it, and it woke up. But normally they would just run away, always. But this time, I guess it felt like I had been watching it, and it knew if I wanted to kill it, I would already have done it. So we had the same moment of figuring each other out, looking at each other, feeling each other. And it's strange that in our society, these kind of emotions and contacts with creatures of nature are so rare. They are so distant from our daily life. How do you think this impacts economy and society that we feel so distant from the natural surrounding we are completely dependent on?
Yeah, I think in many, many ways. I mean, if you, mostly for those of us who are in cities, especially the big cities, and how, as you say, alienated we are from the rest of nature, I think it creates many things in us which are problematic. One is it gives us this sense that we are not part of nature, that nature is out there somewhere. And it's like othering the rest of nature. We do that with peoples also, of course, other so-called races and so on. And because we do that, we tend to look at the rest of nature either as therefore commodity, something we need to exploit for our own resources and our own lifestyles, etc., or as a thing to be consumed. So, you know, suppose I'm a city dweller and I'm interested in wildlife, it means I want to go to a tiger reserve and watch some tigers and take some pictures and be thrilled with that. It doesn't actually allow us to feel that we are part of nature. And the alienation is so complete that we don't even recognize the fact that even in the busiest of cities, we do have lots of elements of nature around us. When I was growing up in New Delhi, I did my schooling and college in New Delhi. And of course, a bustling city, you know, millions and millions of people and very crowded, very congested, very polluted, all of that. But even there, there's a record of 350 to 400 species of birds. There was a large, is a large city forest in the middle of the forest, one of the largest urban forests in the world. And in fact, our organization, the one that I helped to start, which I still work with, began by wanting to, by doing public actions to protect that forest. But for most people, these are invisible. Even though they're there, they might even be in your own backyard, or there might be a tree outside your window, and you sort of, you're so disconnected. Also because of our education system and everything else, and our consumerist system, everything else, that we don't even see that. So I think that is enormously problematic from the point of view of course, the exploitation of nature and things like that, and the unsustainability that we live. But also for us, ourselves, right? I think in some sense, ethically, in terms of, you know, spiritually, etc., we are impoverished as a result of that. Like my one connect with the monkey, which I spoke about, or before that, in, you know, sitting under a wonderful tree or whatever, there's so many, or this kind of connection that you had. In a way, it kind of significantly enhances us individually also, in terms of what we are as a human being, what we are as an individual, how we see ourselves. I think it makes us humbler, because there's a certain humility when you start looking at the awesomeness and the enormity of the rest of nature. There's a certain humility when you realize that we're not the only ones who are thinking and feeling and being happy or being sad or whatever. There are also other species that do that. And when we don't have that connection, I think we lose all of that, which means we're also impoverished ourselves individually
Yeah, a few years back, it was a book published about animals and their languages. And, well, due to modern AI technology, we have been much more aware of how complicated and intricate animal interactions are and how advanced their thinking are that we knew some years ago only. And I think this lack of knowledge about environment is a problem. This is not a new thought. The Swedish natural botanist Linné, he already in the 18th century said that if we lose the name of things, we also lose the interest and the will to, you know, care for them.
I think, you know, what you said also triggered in me something else that Linné says, and a lot of the more sensitive, I think, modern day scientists we had in India, for instance, Jagdish Chandra Bose, who was one of the most incredible botanists of his era, who spoke at that time about how plants can communicate and how we can try and understand the communication of plants, which in more recent times, of course, a lot more scientists and others have also worked on. But what I wanted to say was that, of course, modern science in its best forms, not in its worst forms, does enable us to make these connections or understand the rest of nature better. But intuitively, and through their own traditional forms of knowledge and science or whatever one might want to call it, Adivasis, we call them in India, or indigenous peoples around the world, have been making these connections forever, being able to talk to. I recently read an incredible article on this, I think, Inuit man who talks to whales and understands the language, right? And it's not something one can dismiss easily, because even as a modern scientist examining his what he's saying, it seems that he's on spot, which doesn't mean that modern science should be validifying traditional knowledge in science, but or the other way around. But it's just showing that there are these interconnections, that people can do it through intuition also, through other kinds of connections.
Recently, modern science has obviously also confirmed many traditional knowledges. A lot of the modern drugs are based on what indigenous people have discovered over centuries in nature.
Yeah, absolutely. And beyond that, I mean, if you look at modern quantum physics, which I understand very little of, but, you know, this whole thing of there is no such thing as an objective way of looking at something. You look at something and the reality of that changes. You look at atoms and the reality of that changes, right? And again, this is something that indigenous peoples have spoken about for a long time. They don't objectify the rest of nature. Everything is a subject. Everything has its own agency. But anyway, so that now having lost that in some aspects of modern sort of industrialism and the ways of living in our cities and our industrial lives, for some of us, we tend then to think, because we have a notion of human progress and development, which is of a certain kind, which means more and more and more material consumption, bigger and bigger and bigger infrastructure, more and more sophisticated or so-called sophisticated technologies, etc. I mean, we think of human progress and development in a particular way. The word development itself has got defined not as simply opening up opportunities, which is what it originally has meant, but of more and more economic growth, GDP growth in most parts of the world. Because of that, we tend to then think that anything that stands in the way is a barrier. And what that advertisement, which I show often, because that one image kind of says it all, when it says we have to lay pipelines in the earth for development, if there's a forest in the way, it has to be uprooted because it's a barrier. What that ad does not say, but happens also, is that there are indigenous peoples living in that forest, or there are farmers dependent on the land or whatever, they also need to be uprooted. So in India, over the last few decades of so-called development, we have our government has physically uprooted 60 million people. That's an unofficial figure, because the government does not keep figures, but unofficially. Now, that's larger than the population of most countries in the world. These are people who've just been uprooted from their traditional lands and homes and forests and waters and coasts and whatever, and then been asked to just move off. So in a sense, this alienation is enabling us to cause enormous amounts of violence in the name of development, in the name of governance, in the name of progress, both to the rest of nature and also to fellow human communities.
I think it's interesting you mentioned this, and we should talk more about the perspective of development. But if you read international business magazines, I will just make a few quotes here about what they say about India. The rate of highway construction has tripled since 2015. India, net foreign direct investment as a share of GDP has been 3 times higher in India than in China. Capital investments is now 30% of GDP, higher than that of Taiwan and in par with South Korea. Rather than closed economy reality that previously characterized India, the economy is now more open than China was at a similar stage of development. And after 10 years of hiatus, India is recently beginning signing trade agreements once again. That's the International Business Magazine perspective of India. How do you judge this perspective from the view of true development?
Well, I think for the biggest corporation in the world, this is, of course, great news, right? And those biggest corporations are not just foreign, they're also Indian, as we know. This is all fantastic news because the more expressways and highways you have, the more opening up of the economy there is. The more the government removes barriers to business, the more it does, what is the World Bank's word? Ease of doing business, the more it moves up in the ranking of ease of doing business, quote unquote. The better it is for corporations. Also, the better it is for those in power to hold on to power, because that's the way they try and convince the rest of the population that we are doing development. For 6 decades, if a population has been brainwashed into thinking that this really bigger and bigger highways, etc., bullet trains, everything faster and bigger, etc., is development, then of course people will think, yeah, this is a fantastic government. So that's one side of the picture. And I don't want to negate the fact that because of that, some people do benefit. Of course, there's a percentage of India that certainly benefits from that. But let's see what's happening on the other side, which of course these international business magazines will not talk about. Let me just give you 2 or 3 facts on this. Recently, it came out from government statistics themselves, which are not being very prominently highlighted, that the average nutritional status of Indians is actually going down. So there may be more food all around because of the so-called green revolution, pumping in fertilizers, throwing chemical pesticides, hybrid seeds, all of that. Overall food grains production has increased, so there is greater availability. But as a recent study shown by the Indian Council of Agricultural Research, which is a government institution, showed, over the last 30 to 40 years, the grains that we are now eating have almost no nutritional content. And in fact, they have poison in them. This is something that civil society groups have been shouting for a long, long time, but finally now it's confirmed by a government institution. And so we are actually seeing, we're on the cusp of a significant health crisis. We already have serious health crises of various kinds, but this is another one where malnutrition or undernutrition is already leading to such deficiencies in immunity, etc., that people are falling sick much more than they otherwise should be. So that's one fact I think that's very important. The second one, and this came out, I think, about 12 years back or so, 10 or 12 years back, in a study that was done by the Federation of Indian Chambers of Commerce, which is all the industries, and the Global Ecological Footprint. I was actually very surprised that this federation itself came out with the study, but there were a few kind of more progressive-minded people who were in the environment wing of that federation, and so they brought this out with the Global Ecological Footprint Network. And what that showed was that because of this model of development, India was already using twice its biocapacity, which means twice the capacity of its natural resources to sustain this kind of a growth or to sustain the population.
While India generally has a lower ecological footprint per capita than many countries in the world.
As a global thing, yes. But within itself, within its own boundaries, if you were to look at it, it was already using twice that biocapacity, which is one of the reasons why India actually is going like the imperial West has already done, or China has already been doing. Now India is also going to other parts of the world and seeking resources. There's already sort of economic colonies in Africa, for instance, that Indian companies have. But also that we had already passed the sustainability, if you look at it from the footprints perspective or from other sorts of things, we had already passed that many years back. So if you just take, I can give more and more and more, maybe a third one quickly, because it comes from yet another agency, which in fact has been responsible for this model of development to some extent, the World Bank. The World Bank, again, about a decade back, came out with a report which showed that the economic cost of just five kinds of environmental damage that were taking place: air pollution, water, soil loss because of deforestation, etc. We're already knocking off 5.7% economic GDP from India's economic growth. And at that point in time, I think we were growing at something like maybe 6 or 7%, which in effect meant that we were zero growth. So even from a narrow growth perspective, we were not actually doing very well. And it would be negative if you added all the other environmental and the social costs and the human rights costs. And if one goes into social aspects, psychological aspects of this kind of process, then of course you get to a much more horrifying picture than what this international business magazine would like to tell us.
And the fact that this impacts malnutrition is not only about the quality of what we grow, it's also about the international adverts change on eating habits and centralization of power and food resources.
It is, yeah, it is many things. It is the cultural changes that have taken place. This is since colonial times, and colonization is a big part of that, where they came and told us that eating traditional foods like millets, we call them millets, like we have at least a dozen species of them, is not good. Those are primitive crops. You should be eating wheat and rice, and if possible, heavily processed wheat and heavily processed rice. So this has been around for the last many decades, this kind of feeling. So there's a cultural shift that happened a few decades back and still being pushed through. And then, of course, there's also the global food agreements, the trade agreements, the WTO, even to a large extent the FAO, all of those pushing a certain kind of vision and a certain kind of agricultural policy, which is part of the cause of this really bad situation.
And this vision is, we have endless amount of fossil resources, we have endless amount of pesticides that we can all use to increase yield per hectare of monocultures. But
yes.
What would the alternative vision be for the agriculture then? Not only in India, but the global south and north.
So let me give you one example of a group of 5,000 women farmers who have come up with their own alternative to this Green Revolution package. And that is not an isolated example. There are many similar things in India, but also elsewhere in the world. So what these 5,000 women farmers, they're all small-scale farmers. They are what we call Dalits, so the so-called untouchables of Indian society, Hindu society. So they're triply marginalized as women in a patriarchal society, as Dalits in a very casteist society, and of course as very small landholders, 1 acre, 2 acres at the most. So about 3.5-4 decades back, they kind of started getting together because they realized that they could not sustain the kind of farming the government was pushing on them. They were actually getting more and more indebted. They simply didn't even have the money to buy the chemicals and the seeds and all of that. So they decided, let's try and switch back to our traditional forms of agriculture, but to share our knowledge, to share our seeds, to try and do more collective farming, to fight for land rights for women, to get land redistribution done where there were excess lands with others or with common lands. And through that, it's a very long story, but basically through that, over a process of about a decade or 15 years, they were able to move towards food security for all of those families, which means enough food to eat, but also surplus that they could sell in the market. They then started local exchange programs with consumers, local marketing, their own restaurant in a nearby town, their own shop where they could sell excess produce, under the principle that the first right to the food is the family itself, and only after that put it into the market. No chemicals, so they also have very, very ethical, spiritual principles of how you treat seeds, how you treat the earth as a mother, and many other things. As I said, it's a very long story. But through that, they actually were able to show that in one of the driest parts of India, with no external irrigation, with no hybrid seeds, no chemicals, their own knowledge, but working collectively, they were able to produce enough food. Now, whether this is possible all across India, of course, one will have to see. But there are many, many similar initiatives in different agroecological parts of India and, of course, the rest of the world, which show that there are not one, but there's many viable alternatives to the Green Revolution kind of farming. And that those viable alternatives are especially important for smallholders. We know, if my statistics are correct, something like 70% of the food on the planet is still produced by smallholders, small landholders, not by the big corporations and big farmers. And for them, these are really very viable alternatives. But what that does is it undermines the power of the corporations and of the governments. Because they argue these movements, and there's a movement, Labia Campesina, which is a global movement, which argues for not just food security, but food sovereignty, which means that these farmers, or any producers of any kind for that matter, should have complete control over the means of production, right? Not capitalists and not governments. And they've shown that that's possible. So, but why will the system not accept a model like this? Because it obviously undermines the current power holders who try and capture and control all the seeds and everything to do with agriculture. And this is one of the reasons, by the way, that not quite the same model, but farmers, especially in North India, fought against the attempts by the government of India a couple of years back to bring in laws which would have further commercialized agriculture, further made agriculture go into the hands of corporations. They had to come and camp for a whole year outside Delhi or in Delhi to force the government to withdraw those three laws. And now they're back. They're actually back on the streets because a number of other promises the government had made them are, have not been fulfilled. So now they're actually moving back in tens of thousands to protest again.
Of course, every situation here is local, but there are some global ramifications here. For example, the fact that farmers around the world are more and more indebted, and they are in the hands of banks and finance institutions, and this means a disempowerment. And all research shows that if you have empowered people, people tend to get happier. Was this a result of the Dalit example you gave us now, that this empowerment of actually being in control, did this contribute to well-being? And how was it purely economically, like this self-sufficient of food, but was the surplus enough to have a good well-being life, or was it no change compared to before?
Well, you know, if you look at, I'll come back in a minute to the purely financial part of it, but I think if we think of well-being as something which encompasses multiple aspects of life, right? Good social relationships, a healthy natural environment, which is not going to make you sick. The self-empowerment one feels when one is taking decisions over one's own life rather than somebody else taking those decisions. For women, the feeling of empowerment because they now were equal to the men folk who were earlier taking all the decisions. As Dalits, the feeling of equality in a village which has otherwise always looked down on them, marginalized them, exploited them, right? Now they are able to walk around with their heads held high because they have full respect, self-respect, but also respect of the other villagers. The happiness that they get when there is global recognition for their work. They recently, just 2 years back or so, they got the United Nations Equator Initiative, which is almost like a Nobel Prize for environmental work. So all of this actually brings well-being in multiple complex, nuanced ways. It's not easy to, you can't quantify this kind of stuff, right? Which is why also something like GDP is just so completely nonsensical as an indicator of well-being. In financial terms, I have actually been going there over the last 25 years or so. And I have seen in many of the families how they are now doing much better, even from a material economic point of view, right? More assets in the house, the ability to repair their houses, which earlier they did not have. If there is sickness in the family, the ability to actually go and see a doctor, which was never possible earlier. The ability to send their kids to school. They actually even started their own school because they believe that the government schools or the private schools don't teach the children what should be taught. So the whole education system also needs to be transformed. But even if they send their kids to school, the normal conventional schools, at least they're able to send them. Earlier, they would never be able to even send the kids to school because either they didn't have the money or because the rest of the kids would treat them as untouchables. Right? All of that has transformed. They have their own media station. They started India's first radio station, by the way, before it was even legal to run a community radio station. They have their own filmmaking unit. They've made more than 100 films. You know, so if you see all of that happening and you see the confidence and the smiles and the jokes and the way in which they organize, they have an annual biodiversity festival, the way in which these women actually organize it, where thousands of people come from outside to see it. I don't know. It's you know, I can't even describe it, the sense of well-being that one is talking.
Whoever I interview all around the world, when we talk about alternatives to capitalism and well-being economy, it always ended up with these stories where the normal capitalist model is like, you are yourself an atom that looks out for yourself, and then the market will figure everything out efficiently in the end. Whenever I hear these examples, you always see cultural impact, sociological impact, increased cooperation rather than only competition. I have a similar story, a podcast guest in the Swedish version of this podcast. It was a farmer, a traditional farmer. He was on the poorer side of the village, so the soil was not as good. So they had to work together, and they cooperated more on his side. While the richer southern part of the village, they had their own big cars and their own big farms, and they went to church alone and went home alone, while the others lingered around and found projects to cooperate around. And this made him feel that this system of trying to find a balance in community is better, and then he transformed from traditional farmer to regenerative farmer. And then this connection with the living life and the planet and the earth. And this led to many other cultural and sociological advances. So whenever you try to resist the logic of being alone, fighting for yourself, dominating women and nature and other races and so on, that comes so close with today's economy, you see that it's not only about economy, it's so many other changes in society we need to do. And you have been working with this logic of flower of transformation. I think this is a very nice image, and I would like you to explain the different petals in the flower of transformation, because I think it creates a really nice image of how we can have an alternative development.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think maybe before I do the flower, it might be useful to give one or two other examples, because the one I've given of the Dalit women farmers is a particular context. It's about farming, it's a traditional occupation, etc. But let's take a look at maybe an urban example, where in a city...
Sure, I love these kinds of examples.
I also know so. I mean, storytelling, one can go on for hours. But just to give you quickly one or two. So I think if you look at urban, because, you know, cities are obviously a huge challenge. They are extremely unsustainable wherever they are in the world. They end up exploiting the rural, the countryside. Internally, they have huge issues of inequality, the rights that people should have to the city services. 40-50% of the poor population doesn't have that in many cities in India, certainly. So anyway, there are lots of issues with cities also. And here too, we have examples in many parts of the world where people are trying to do multiple things. I mean, work in solidarity to help each other with things like housing, with access to adequate water and energy, with managing waste in a much more sensible, responsible way, with claiming the rights to decision-making where they are. So they're saying, why should our settlement or our urban neighborhood be planned by somebody sitting far away and be budgeted for by somebody sitting far away? We should be at the core of planning and budgeting wherever we are, including in a city. And there's lots of examples of that. And also examples of recommoning. You know, including in Europe, for instance, the fight to recommon private parking spaces, as an example, to make them urban gardens, which 20 or 30 or 50 families around that can actually cultivate together or have their own plots and share seeds and share food and, you know, build up social relations around the act of gardening, farming. So recommoning of spaces, so many different things, trying to create spaces which are climate-wise much more sensible and climate friendly. So I think if you look at that, in fact, last year I was also in, you know, talking about solidarity and cooperation. I was in Germany for a month and I visited 3 or 4 communes. And it was fascinating to see how in this extremely capitalist, extremely individualistic, extremely selfish society, which modern industrialism has driven people to, there were more and more, there were 200 communes, I heard, where people are trying to live together, share resources, share a kitchen, share vehicles, share things like childcare. So if parents have to actually go and work somewhere, so there are other people in the community who are taking care of them. They don't have to hire a babysitter or whatever. And all of them actually saying how much happier their lives are as a result of this kind of sharing, this kind of cooperation, this kind of solidarity. We also did some fantastic, very, very interesting case studies in the COVID pandemic. In India, we have about 70 stories from other parts of the world, about 25, 30, which showed that where people had these systems of cooperation, or could rebuild them quickly, where they had collective access to the most important resources that their lives depended on, where they had more localized exchanges, not long distance ones, where they had a more distributed leadership, not like one person who is, you know, taking all the decisions. They were able to cope, not just cope, but thrive through the COVID pandemic period much more, much better than a lot of others where things just collapsed very badly. And so what this leads me to is, yes, this flower of transformation. So, which is based on lots and lots of these examples that we've been looking at. So basically what we say is that if you think of a flower with five petals, which are overlapping with each other, petal number one, politics, petal number two, economics, petal number three, society or social relations, petal number four, culture and knowledge, and petal number five, environment and ecology. Bit of an artificial distinction, but just one way of trying to understand what's happening, sorts of transformations taking place on the ground. And you begin to see that in each of these, there is a challenge to the dominant system of exploitation, inequality, injustice, etc., and an attempt to either bring back old systems, if still relevant, or create new ones. Quickly, in a half a minute each, the politics petal is about saying that democracy is not about elections as much as it is about us claiming power where we are, in our own collectives, our village, our urban neighborhood, our school, our NGO, whatever collectives we're in, that we are the power holders. There's a village in central India which gave this slogan 30 years back. We elect the government in New Delhi. In our village, we are the government. Nobody takes decisions for us except our own village assembly. And we build the capacity of everybody in the village assembly, including women who have been traditionally marginalized, to be equal parts of that decision-making process.
Is that the city of Bhuj?
No. This is a village called Mendhalekha in central India. And then learning from that, many more have also joined in. There's a federation of 90 villages that has got together with a similar kind of objective. And so the Bhuj example you gave is the urban example that I was mentioning, where several settlements in the city of Bhuj have asserted their rights to urban planning and budgeting and doing as much as they can for themselves, create much more dignified housing, including in the poorest parts of the town. But anyway, that's politics, really, about claiming power where we are and making the state, insofar as the state still exists, making it accountable for the things that it should be doing for us. Some movements have gone beyond that and actually said that we don't even need a centralized state. If we're able to create more and more political self-reliance of this kind and confederate over larger areas, we don't actually need a central state. This is what the Zapatista movement in Mexico is saying. This is what the Kurdish freedom movement is saying.
Rojava.
Yeah, Rojava is one part of that. Iran, Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Quadri Junction. Many indigenous peoples have been arguing for self-determination and self-governance. So that's the political petal. The second one is economic. This is not in any order of priority. I'm just giving you randomly. So the second one is economic, where, like I said, during the COVID pandemic, those who did well were the ones who had collective control over their productive resources. That could be land, it could be forests, it could be machinery, it could be tools, it could be knowledge, anything that is useful as a means of production. Collective control over that rather than somebody else controlling it. But also, it's an economy of caring and sharing. If I have seeds, they're not just mine, they belong to the community. And if anybody needs those seeds or that knowledge or that water or the machinery or the tools, I will share it with them, right? So you actually create an economy which is much more about exchanges, about caring, about empathy, and not just about making money. And that's an economy where also the invisibilized role of marginalized peoples like women, very, very invisible, a huge role that women play as people who are holding up the house, for instance, is also recognized, right? And recognizing that, men then also say, oh, well, we should also then be doing housework. Why should only the women be doing it?
I think here is an interesting aspect. In some studies, when you reduce working time, men's share of household work increases. And the true free time without household work or paid work increases more for women than for men when you reduce working time. So I think this is an interesting thing in reaching equality too.
Absolutely. And then one goes beyond that. And okay, so let me give you another very quick example. So we have in Western India, the traditional occupation of handloom weaving craft, which is actually fairly common across India, but has seriously declined because of mass industrial production. That has come back because of certain innovations, the use of an organic cotton, producing some products that sell well in the market, etc. Now, leaving aside the a little bit of contradiction of the fact that it's based on still selling in the external market, leaving that aside for a minute, what has happened here is that many young people have come back to handloom weaving. They had gone off to work in industries, they had gone off to work even all the way to the Middle East to work and have come back, many of them. And their articulation, I just quote one person, a boy called Prakash, who was weaving carpets, learning from his father. And he says, I asked him, why don't you go into computers or IT or something like that, right? You're educated, you can easily do it. He said, yeah, but you know, when you're sitting on a computer, he was telling me, because I was working on my laptop, when you're sitting on a computer, you have the same stance that I do. You're using your mind and you're using your hands. I do the same thing, but I'm also using my heart. I said, what does that mean? He said, if I don't put my love into this product, you won't buy it as a consumer. Plus, you come and talk to me for 2 hours doing your research. I can take those 2 hours off. If I was sitting in an industry with a boss over my head, I would not be able to take that time off. I'm sitting at home. I can have a chai break whenever I want with my family. I'm being creative. I am producing my own things. I'm sustaining the heritage of my own community, the crafts heritage of my community. But I'm also innovating, learning new things, new techniques, new products. You know, so it's a very interesting narrative that is about dissolving the binary between work and leisure. That is also something that, you know, this whole phenomenon of weekdays and weekends, of work and vacation, is a very, relatively very new concept in human history. And it's only when we start questioning that and say, look, if work was actually truly creative, enjoyable, productive, you wouldn't have this, right? You could do whatever you wanted at whatever point in time. In a sense, that's what Marx also said when he said, I can be a critic in the morning and a farmer in the afternoon. I don't remember the exact quote. This is what Gandhi said all along, that this is what we need to do. So
we also talked about this in this podcast with the guy standing on basic income, that only a third of the population in the world find their work meaningful.
Absolutely. I call those deadlyhoods, by the way. From livelihoods, we move to deadlyhoods. And I think it was David Graeber, the late anthropologist, who called them bullshit jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the only slight quibble I have with that is I think bullshit is actually a very useful product. But anyway, unfortunately, I never conversed with him. I would have told him, and he probably would have agreed. But yeah, so that's an aside. So
it's actually touching my life there, because my professor at the university went to India to do very efficient, easy to copy ovens that used bullshit as fuel rather than deforestation. So saving 90% of the energy use, and the bullshit was actually the raw material for those ovens.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's been an energy source for thousands of years here. And much as fertilizing the soil, all kinds of things.
I think it's interesting. The examples you give and what you talk about is actually true freedom compared to the traditional capitalist Western logic of freedom. So if you have this well-being economy, if you have this change that you talk about, how would that promote freedom in its true sense?
Yeah, so I think... the capitalist system has been extremely good at trying to convince us that freedom is about being able to go to a supermarket and choose from 30 different brands of soap, or the sort of liberal, democratic, conventional political system has convinced us that freedom is about choosing one political party, another political party if you don't like the current one, right? So the very narrow concepts of freedom, or even worse than that, of course, for the United States, if a country doesn't give us cheap petrol, we can go and bomb it. That's our notion of freedom. So as opposed to all of that, what freedom, azadi, one of the terms that's probably used all across from Central Asia all the way to South Asia, is really about, yes, as an individual or a collective or a community or a country, we assert our identity. We assert that we will be making the choices that we want to make. We assert that our needs and aspirations, we will do what we can to meet those needs and aspirations, but not at the cost of anybody else's freedom. And so Swaraj, the meaning which Gandhi brought back, it's an old Indian term, but Gandhi brought it back during the independence struggle. He was very careful to say Swaraj is not about self-rule. It's not about independence of India from British colonial rule only. It is much deeper. It is about the right to be self-determined and autonomous and free, but with responsibility towards others' freedoms, which means there's rights and responsibilities. There's freedoms and constraints. He was saying that the rights has to go hand in hand with duties and responsibilities. Otherwise, it's an incomplete concept. And you cannot be free if what you're doing is making somebody else unfree. You cannot even be free if you know that there is somebody else unfree and you're not doing anything about it. So for us, to have freedom means nothing unless we can stand up in solidarity with, you know, people in Gaza who are being bombed out of existence right now. So that is indeed a much deeper sense of freedom or azadi or self-determination or autonomy or self-governance, or self-rule or democracy.
And again, it's based on participation and not exclusion. Like if you have freedom based on capacity to buy something in monetary terms, it's not true freedom because some people might not have the capacity to partake of those freedoms offered because they're based on a mean they don't have. So it's a more universal freedom based on solidarity.
Not just that. Absolutely, Carl, what you're saying, absolutely. But not just that. It's also that, is it really a choice that I have 30 brands of soap to go and buy from? And maybe some others don't have it. That's one part of it. But I'm saying even just for myself, do I actually have the choice of making my own soap if I want to? Do I have the choice of going to a local neighbor or the next village or town where there are traditional handmade soap makers who are struggling because there's mass production of soaps which are much cheaper? So freedom goes well beyond even just a choice I might have in a modern consumerist society. It is also about being able to do things myself. I remember many years back, I was in the US and I went to one of these fairs, festivals in Maine, where there was a big slogan saying, the future is handmade. People want the freedom to be able to make their own things. That's coming back. Even in industrial societies, people are actually, our societies in India are moving towards mechanization, and you folks are actually wanting to come back to making things with the hand. So, or what that carpet maker boy said, you know, the freedom to actually do things with my own hands, my heart, my head, but also take off when I want, have chai when I want, etc. That, all of that actually gets encompassed in the notion of freedom or of azadi. But anyway, the third sphere, the third petal is social justice. And this is very important because you could, in theory, you could have, and in practice, you could have political, radical political democracy of the kind I described. You could have radical economic democracy of the kind I described, where local people are in control of the land or productive resources, etc. But you could still have serious social injustices. And in a country like India, this is still very serious because we're talking about thousands of years of gender injustice, of casteism, and others, like ableism, like people with disabilities are often marginalized. So the struggles for social justice and equality and doing away with discriminations of various kinds, old or new, that's the third petal of this flower of transformation. So when those Dalit women farmers were struggling to not just create food security and sovereignty, but also against their status as Dalits and women, they were adding that third sphere of transformation also.
What kind of tools and tactics can we use to increase the strength of social web? What have you seen has been successful here?
Well, I think it's a combination of enabling the agency of the most marginalized peoples to get expressed, which can happen by themselves organizing or being enabled to organize with the help of people from outside. Sometimes they don't have their own strengths to do it because of hundreds of years of exploitation. It could also be with the help of government policies of what we call reservation here, where certain occupations or seats in a university or a school are reserved for those who have been historically marginalized. Then larger circles of solidarity. This is very important because when marginalized peoples speak up or when they fight back, there is going to be obviously those in power are going to hit back. It could be men in families where women are asserting their voices. It could be the so-called upper castes who don't want the marginalized caste to, whoever is in, you know, has been in control or in power for a long time. It could be the government, could be corporations. So you need those larger circles of solidarity also to make this kind of social justice and transformations possible. So that's the third sphere. The fourth one is about culture and knowledge. And again, going back to the same examples, whether the Dalit women farmers or the urban transformations or any of them, or the central Indian villages arguing for local democracy, they are saying that they're asserting that their own cultural identity, their language, their food cuisines, their ways of relating to the rest of nature and each other, etc., and their knowledge systems, which are not necessarily the same as modern science and technology, but could be very different, that they are all worthy of respect and that they will build their transformations on them, but they may not necessarily stick only to them. They're also open to saying, okay, maybe we use some aspects from modern science and technology, or we also learn English or Hindi or whatever, so we can relate with equality to the outside world. Right? But we will also assert our own language and our own cultures. That is also very much, and there are again many, many movements of this kind. For instance, the reassertion of tribal languages, indigenous languages in many parts of the world, right? Or the fights for slow, traditional, local food or cuisines, So, and some of them are beginning to also get policy recognition. Just recently, for instance, in one of the southern Indian states, a new commission for indigenous or tribal languages has been set up to try and enable, there's more than, I think there's three dozen languages which can then also become formally recognized, right? So that they don't die out. So that's the whole sphere. And in that culture and knowledge also, to fight against privatization, against intellectual property rights, against the theft of knowledge by corporations or governments or others, and to say that, no, these must remain in the commons or must be brought back into the commons, knowledge commons, cultural commons, copyleft instead of copyright, open source technologies and things like that. So that's the fourth petal of transformation.
The traditional capitalist logic here is that you will have no development if you don't have copyrights. What he has to say against that?
Well, I mean, you know, if you look at most of human history, except for the last couple of hundred years, we didn't have intellectual property rights. Okay, some very small elements of traditional medicinal knowledge were held by faith healers or traditional medicine men, mostly men. But those are very small elements. Most knowledge was otherwise in the open, in the commons. And we've had, I mean, can anybody tell us who invented the wheel? Would any of the so-called modern progress have happened without the wheel? Nobody claimed a copyright on it. It was invented, one of the most incredible inventions in human history. And you can think of hundreds or thousands of things like that. Most human innovation has actually happened in the commons, not private. We tend to only look at the last 100 years of innovation, that also mostly industrial technical innovations.
And we also tend to look at only the last chain in innovation. For example, 9 out of 10 fundamentally new medicines are actually innovated with public money in universities, and they are only then further developed into a drug by the industry, and then they have the 100% of the copyright. So we can also see here that they get a false claim to the innovation. It's done by public money in universities, but then they claim the whole protection from the current system.
Absolutely. And also, I think there was a study more than 20 years back which showed that I think 85% of modern medicine is based on traditional medical systems, right? Especially traditional knowledge of plants and how those have been used in traditional systems. So without those hundreds of years of innovations and trial and error and all that communities have been doing, so much of even modern medicine would simply not have been there, or would have had to spend huge amounts of more money to actually get where they have got.
And if we destroy the ecosystems they are based on, we are lost forever.
Yeah, so nature, of course, is never in the picture, in the intellectual property rights, of course. nature is also being privatized, or the contributions of nature are never recognized in that whole system. Or even what somebody like Einstein said, that if I'm looking further, it's because I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. He had the humility to say that, right? Anyway, so that's the fourth petal. And then the fifth petal, which some people say should not be a fifth petal, but should be at the foundation of all of this, is ecological wisdom. Working within the earth, being part of nature, respecting the rest of life, just as we want human rights, the rights of the rest of nature, looking at sort of trying to understand what are the ecological limits within which we should be restricting human activity, economic and other human activity, and respecting. We know that we've already crossed most of the planetary limits, according to the latest scientific assessments. So all that evidence is already with us, which is a result of the first few minutes of our conversation of how our alienation and domination has enabled us to do this. So that's the fifth sphere. Now, if you think of the intersections, any of the examples I gave you, like going back to those Dalit women farmers, you see that they're trying to work transformations along all of these five spheres. It's not like they're stuck in only one. But this is a problem with a lot of civil society and, of course, with a lot of government, because they're stuck in departments. They're stuck in their silos. We are stuck in our silos, academic disciplines, government departments, etc., stuck saying, oh, I'm working on agriculture and I have nothing to do with health or water or land, right? I'm working on, physics and I have nothing to do with anything else. As if the interconnections don't exist. And this is partly also a result of a certain form of Western modern industrial knowledge systems and modern governance systems, it's apparently a so-called democratic governance systems. So, the intersections are really very important to work on and to take further. And then at the core of this flower of transformation, this is where the intersections also become very interesting. You know, we spoke about solidarity and cooperation, right? At the core of this flower of transformation is ethics and principles. And why this is important is because people often ask me, they say, okay, how do we replicate what the Dalit women farmers did? Or how do we upscale it? And my response has always been no, neither replication nor upscaling. Because replication assumes that your situation is the same as theirs. It's not. Your soil conditions might be different. Your social and cultural relations may be different. So, and neither is upscaling, because it's not like those Dalit women farmers want their organization called the Deccan Development Society to become bigger and bigger and bigger and become some big or multinational corporation, right? But what is important is outscaling, which means we learn the principles they used of cooperation, of working with the earth, of respecting seeds and earth as spiritual entities, of sharing knowledge, of being available for those who really need them, of claiming self-reliance, of claiming autonomy. Those basic principles and values are at the core of that flower of transformation. And those principles, if we can learn from each other and then apply them in our own context with whatever modifications are necessary, and then connect up. So these 5,000 farmers here, another 1,000 somewhere else, another 10,000 somewhere else in India and then across the world. You connect up to create the scale. So that's why I call it outscaling, and to create the critical mass and then to push further and further for policy shifts or other macro shifts that are necessary.
I think this comes very close to the Zapatista idea about multiverse and pluriverse, really? And that every solution doesn't need to be the same everywhere. And you have been working a lot with these issues. So if you would advise government in, for example, Europe to promote the Dalit logic and principles and experience, what could they do to assist people in taking more control and reverting power back to communities? What kind of policy issues could help facilitate this development?
Yeah, I did a paper last year actually for GIZ, main German aid agency, on how international assistance should be transformed with all of these perspectives in mind. And there were two or three things that I put forward. One, for countries in Europe like Germany to look at its own footprint across the world. So to be able to transform its own production and trade and consumption patterns in a way that is not impinging on or taking away the ecological space of other parts of the world, which clearly it is right now. So that's also part of the, let's say, the degrowth movement in Europe itself. The second is to say that insofar as it continues, you know, have aid packages for other countries, so-called developing countries, that these should be examined from this holistic perspective. Suppose you're giving support for agricultural progress in a country in Africa or in Asia, right? What are the implications for the land? What are the implications for the cultural aspects? What are the implications for inequality within the community, et cetera, et cetera? Unless you look at it more holistically using something like the flower of transformation, you will not actually know whether you're overall benefiting that society or not. And that is, again, rarely done. And part of that is also saying, okay, if you really want to do it, have long-term support. You know, these 3-year, 5-year cycles don't mean anything. All the examples I'm talking about, including Dalit farmers, is at least 10, 15 years of transformation before something actually settles in, before the institutions, local institutions that can take it forward are, you know, established. So these 3-year, 5-year cycles are very problematic. And the third thing I said was to decolonize yourselves. All those who have colonized the world are also self-colonizers. You know, there's the certain view of what is development. Certain view of what is, you know, okay, we are now very well developed, we will come and help the rest of the world. In a way, that is a self-colonization, and that's also restricting yourselves as individuals and societies to be enjoying life in a much fuller way, where you then realize that, okay, for instance, the spiritual relationship that the Dalit women farmers have with the earth, oh, wow, that's a perspective I never thought of. And maybe if I treat the earth under my feet in Germany or Europe in the same way, I might actually be happier. So lots of decolonization that needs to be done in the relations between the global north and the south. And I would quote Ivan Illich here, the Austrian philosopher, thinker, writer, spent most of his life in Mexico, I think, who once told a university in the US who invited him for a lecture because the university students were going to go to Latin America for helping the local people to develop. He said, look, if you're going to help them or assist them, please don't, just stay here. He was a very rude guy, okay, very, very straight. He said, if you are going with an open mind to learn from them and also teach and impart what you know to them as equals, then you're most welcome. But do not go there with this very patronizing view that, oh, I am developed, I have something to offer to others, and I'm going to give it to them. So that would be also my response to anybody in Europe who wants to improve the situation.
Well, this is exactly the experiences we have from Canada and the Netherlands regarding municipal foreign policy and municipal development assistance and cooperation, because there when you are more equal, if you meet your local counterpart somewhere in the world, it's per definition a more equal relationship. And that is also, I think, assisting like local to local cooperation. Another thing you have been talking about is the word radical that I think is a nice touch. People have forgotten that it means root. It goes back to the roots of things.
Uh-huh.
I think part of when you explain what changes we can do is like, don't be affected by the colonial logic, neither as a European or an Indian or wherever you live, but go back to be radical and feel what is right.
Yeah.
And I think this perspective where radical is transformed into something more basic, I think, is an interesting concept that you mentioned.
Well, you know, one of my favorite pastimes is to look at the original meanings of words. Because the words we use, the meanings that we use today are actually very often very distorted from their original meanings. Radical is one, because in India, we tend to think of radicalization as being people killing each other. Which is completely the opposite of what it actually means. Going to one's ecological roots, one's cultural roots, one's roots as a human being, let's say, or roots as life. But also many other terms, right? Like democracy, I just mentioned. Democracy has gotten restricted to mean elections and political parties, whereas the original meaning is power of the people. And we tend to forget that. Or school. You know, we spoke just briefly about the education system. The word school comes from skole in Greece, which meant learning with leisure. Now, it was often restricted to a certain leisure class. But the point was that you're learning not as, 95% of India's schools are prisons, nothing to do with leisure, nothing to do with creativity.
Well, and also India has a sad history there where this education system was outright in purpose of colonialism the beginning.
Absolutely. So-called Lord Macaulay. And he was very explicit about it. He said if Great Britain wants to continue ruling India, it will not be through the army, it will be through brainwashing the Indian population. And that's still happening, unfortunately, despite us being independent. Going back to the original meanings of words and reviving them and bringing back those original meanings, not just as language, but also on the ground, is also a very crucial part of transformation.
I think a lot of you say is linked to participation rather than being a spectator, both in regards to democracy and culture and social development and nature, like participation and integration into these processes, rather than just going to vote every 4 years, just letting the power loose for the great corporations, or just going to a spectacle rather than actually being part of a cultural development. I think this relation between spectator and participator is an interesting difference. How could you promote and help people of being participants rather than just spectators?
Yeah, I think that's a huge challenge, because the system actually makes us, I think what Pink Floyd once called, comfortably numb. So we... As long as you can go down and get your food, or you get water in your taps, and you get the electricity at the flick of a switch, and so on and so forth, you think that, well, you're okay, yeah, and the government is providing. And this is especially the case, for instance, with people in supposedly good welfare societies like many of the European countries. So you tend to switch yourself off from problems that others might be facing, or even you yourself might be facing in terms of your own psychological, cultural sorts of things. And to sort of snap people out of that and say that, look, you could actually be happier and healthier and whatever, but also you can contribute to other people's happiness and health if you just make these changes in your lives. And I think this is why something like, say, the German communes are very important to actually point to say that how people are actually living more healthier and happier lives, how their well-being is increased simply by making the shift to more communal living, more shared living kind of thing. Now, so you can start that very small. It can be that in your own urban neighborhood, start taking part in the neighborhood assemblies or in whatever local institutions exist, or go to the school where your children are and see if you can help a little bit in improving the quality of education or improving the facilities in that school. Or even for your own health sake, even from a somewhat selfish point of view, see if you can make a little bit of a difference in how the garbage in your locality is looked at, or how the pollution in your city is to be tackled, right? So I think starting small, because people are a little scared and worried about doing very big things, starting small and creating that sense that you could be more involved in decisions that affect your own lives. That's how, so many initiatives have started. And then you can get bigger and you can get so more ambitious or more larger in terms of participation. But there's, I think, 3 or 4 crucial elements to this. For me, there's 4 crucial elements of functioning good democracy, like what we would here in India call Swaraj or self-rule, radical democracy. One is people need to have the rights to participate. And to me, that needs to be either legally or in some other customary way, a right that can be enforced in all decisions that affect my life. I may or may not take part, but I should have that right. Second, the capacities. Now, here in India, for instance, the reservation we have for women in decision-making units at the village level, 50% or 30%, is there. So women will go and sit, but for hundreds of years, they've been told to keep quiet, so they're not going to go and actually say anything. So building that, empowering the capacity to actually speak up and be equal in making your voice heard. The third thing is accessibility to forums of decision making. We have examples where a so-called development project is to come up, and by law the government is supposed to do a public hearing, but they'll do it 50 kilometers away where nobody can travel. Or you might have an assembly process where, you know, there are strong men standing outside, and if the marginalized people try and go in, they're kind of kicked out. So accessible forums of decision-making is the third crucial element. And the fourth one, which is the most important but the most difficult, is the maturity to take decisions that are responsible to everybody, not just to one.
Yeah.
Right? So therefore, not a majoritarianism kind of thing, more consensus building based on capacities, decentralized capacities, more distributed leadership, and responsible not just to other human beings, but to the rest of nature. So that maturity, that wisdom of decision-making is obviously very, very crucial. All of this comes in when you talk about meaningful participation.
I have also encountered examples in India about sociocracy. Is that something you would like to develop on?
Yeah, so I think sociocracy, I mean, I haven't really studied too much myself, but I think a lot of the examples I can think of already have elements of that. I mean, Swaraj is one of the words that we use in India. So sociocracy is a new word that's probably coming from the West, I'm not sure. But Swaraj, so when Gandhi was speaking about it, the meaning was precisely that, that I am free, my community is free, we have autonomy, we have self-determination, but we're also responsible towards others, which means we're also listening to others. Just as much as important to talk is as important to listen. And built into that is also non-violence, which is not just about hitting each other, but also the language one uses, how we behave with others. And I would again extend that to other species. So non-violence or peace is a very crucial part of that. So in different ways, many of these radical democracy initiatives kind of express what otherwise could be called sociocracy. And sociocracy has a few other elements that are specific to specific contexts. But again, I would say it's a pluriverse. Let's not use any one model. There are multiple different models, yeah, with the commonalities of the values and principles like I was talking about, equality, solidarity, etc.
Well, thank you so much. And I will try to be less colonialistic and maybe use the word Swaraj next time I talk about this. But thank you so much. And I think this ends where we began, actually, because your focus on pluriverse and multiverse is a bit copying the logic of nature and biodiversity and how things are interlinked and not one thing dominates everywhere, because then you have a monoculture and you have problems. So I think learning again where we started this episode, learning from nature in order to solve our problems. So I thank you so much for this talk today.
Thank you. That was a stimulating discussion. Thanks a lot.